This is a Glassbox Media podcast.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers, and negotiating those difficult moments along the way. I'm Giles Prady-Phillips, and with me, as ever, is the imperious Jim Daly.
Hang on, I'm just going to Google imperious. Arrogant and domineering. I would say those are two of the qualities that people most associate.
It's because you look so confident today.
Do I? I'll take that.
Yeah.
Nice to look confident, isn't it? Even if you're not. I think it's probably quite a good quality to give out there, I think. I don't know how one does that. I'm delighted that you think I look confident today. I don't know what I've done. But yeah, I'd like to give out more confident
vibes.
Yeah. I think I would, but don't know how.
Yeah, it's a funny one, confidence, isn't it? Because there's a fine line between confidence and arrogance, which sometimes those two things get... you see it in sport and, well, in the world of entertainment and all sorts of things. People sort of kind of muddle those things up sometimes. I think some people... I think you can be confident but not be arrogant. But I think sometimes if you come across as confident, people think you're arrogant.
It's a fine line. It's a very
you're not arrogant in any way. I'm just putting that out.
Oh, thank you.
So I was meant in a complimentary way. You're looking confident, but not arrogant.
Interesting. Yeah, but again, it is a fine line. I think to tread that line.
I think some people don't like hearing people being confident. If someone's confident in their ability, and they say it, they voice it. I think sometimes people find that maybe that's a British thing. Because I think like our transatlantic friends. Would be more openly confident.
Yeah, and I don't mind it. Do you? I quite like being around confident people, erring on the side of confidence maybe rather than arrogance, because it is quite a positive. I think it's quite a positive energy, and invariably people like that want you to do well for yourself and be confident. I think that kind of rubs off sometimes.
Because it can be attached to encouragement sometimes, I think.
Yeah, confidence. Positivity. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. But I think there's the Britishness, I think, maybe to the...
We don't tend to like... Yeah, I think that's a thing. We don't like it, I think. Particularly from public figures, if they're, they're coming across as confident. I think I'm thinking of sport in a big way, because often, like, I say sportsmen sort of... will talk positively about what they've done and some people don't like it. You sort of see it on...
But you need to get to the very top of the sports game.
Exactly.
Confidence.
If you're... Well, not even if you're a top sportsman. If you've done if you're a public figure doing sport or whatever it is, I'm using sport as an example, then you have to be bloody good. So...
Quite. I think you have to be driven, I think.
Yes.
And I guess confidence comes from... it's definitely related to sort of being driven. So Anyway, this isn't a sports episode. I mean, it's not a sports episode. Great intro for Patrick a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. But I would say, funny enough, our guest today, Arthur Smith, who is a absolutely tremendous legend of comedy,
absolutely.
Legend of the British comedy scene, has been around for a long time doing, you know, he talked about doing Fringe Festival since 1977. Yeah. And I would say, actually, he was very confident. He's a very confident guest, obviously very confident in his own skin, and a very confident poet. I mean, obviously he talked about poetry, and we did some poetry recitals, which some people can hear on the Patreon. There we are. Let's got that in
beautifully
early.
Done.
If you want to hear some lovely poetry recitals and Jim attempting to fart, you can hear that on the Patreon. All become clear.
If you're wondering, if you're wondering which of the two of us, that me and Charles, is the cultured one, there's your answer.
Which one's the author? Which one's the writer?
which one's
the one that does football stuff and does comedy?
Yeah, there you go. Absolutely. Yeah. I could not have pigeonholed myself more. No. But anyway, if you do want to hear that, then obviously join the Patreon, because I don't think we've ever done that before, possibly won't again since. But there are reasons that we've gone into that world, which will be explained in the main episode.
Yeah, this was a really fun episode. Always great talking to Arthur. Obviously, lots of fantastic anecdotes, and he's hilarious and just a brilliant, brilliant company. And he's done so much and seen so much. And it was, I think you and I knew it would be a really, really sort of easy conversation because Arthur's just a great raconteur. And it's just really great to talk to him and spend some time with him.
And he gave me the key to Balham as well.
Oh, of course. Which is vital.
Which tomorrow I used to live in. All the while I lived there, that was something I really wanted. So that's nice to get that as well. Speaking of things we want, Giles, we'd love people to get in contact with us and let us know what they think about any episode, really, of Blank. And you can do that in various ways, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, where the handle is...
@BlankPod.
It is indeed for all of them. And here's someone that's done just that on Twitter from Craig. And his handle is @MehMusings. @Meh_musings. I'm sure your musings are better than meh, Craig. Mm. In fact, I know they are because you've tweeted two of them to us. So here's one of them. Slowly but surely working my way through Blank Pod episodes on my lunchtime 10K constitutional. Not sure what that is. Is he running? Anyway, great. Henry Winter might be the best, not just football knowledge, but also stands up for the game as a great social conscience and even drops in some music references. Pick up Idols. There we go. Yes, that was a great episode with Henry.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Henry, and he's so erudite and a brilliant brilliant knowledge of the game. Just incredible. Yeah, that was a really interesting and fascinating conversation with him. And
it was.
Yeah.
Allowed me to really sort of delve into my football obsession. Mm. And Craig's picked another one as well with another football person that came on. He's put another day. So I think I said this the next day. Yeah, just 3 days later. He's cracking on with these episodes.
Yeah, good work.
Another episode, which is 9 months past. It's, oh my God, is it 9 months? Anyway, it's the Emma Jones episode. Oh, yeah. Obviously a big Leeds fan. Was that 9 months ago?
Oh, it doesn't feel like it, does it?
Bravo for speaking in such an honest and open way. Everything he won the podcast. Yeah, Emma was, my word, what a fantastic guest. Very raw episode, but I mean, she was, brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, Emma's brilliant and doing so well, and it's lovely to see that. But yeah, that was a very sort of emotional and poignant episode, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Craig. And you can tweet us @BlankPod or message us on Instagram and Facebook. If you've liked Craig going through the old episodes and you're enjoying any, then please do let us know.
Yeah, and we've been obviously putting out some classic episodes recently because we had a little break from releasing episodes so we could catch up. And so there's some, you know, if you haven't heard them before, there's some really good old classics that we've been putting back out. So you can delve in and or re-listen if you've already heard them before.
Exactly. So plenty for you to get your teeth into. Speaking of, I think it's time to get on with this week's fantastic episode.
I think we should, yeah.
So this is, as Charles said, comedy legend Arthur Smith on the Blank Podcast.
It hasn't been nice here. I'm down on the South Coast. It's been absolutely pissing it down with rain.
Oh, yeah.
Has it?
Yeah, it's been horrendous.
We had a bit of lightning and thunder last night. It was good.
Yeah, I like a bit of lightning and thunder.
I'm quite,
Yeah, I quite like the drama of it all.
I agree.
We did too, and it was really bright. And I actually thought that our security lights had come on, and we were getting burgled by someone because the light was that bright. It was I guess it was actually lightning. Yeah.
Are you both on the south coast then?
No, I'm in Chesham in Buckinghamshire.
Very nice.
But I used to live in the People's Republic of Ballard.
Ah, well, congratulations. Yeah. Why did you leave us?
Twice. I don't, because I couldn't afford to live there anymore. Twice I lived there. I loved it. Absolutely loved it in Ballon. But, I've moved out. But my heart is still there.
Rightly so. In that case, I'll grant you the freedom of Ballon.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
Arthur, we'll start if we may. If that's all right with you. So you're from Bermondsey originally, though.
That's right. Yeah.
What was your youth like? What was growing up like in Bermondsey?
Well, it was very good because I had a lovely mother and father. My dad was a copper, PC Sid Smith. We lived in a block of police flats. I think they're now student flats that were right next to what was then Surrey Docks. So we used to look out the window and see all these ships, and then the streets had lots of drunken sailors wandering the streets. And directly opposite the block of flats was a bomb site because, of course, this is the 50s. Late 50s, there were still loads of bomb sites all around London and I presume all over the country at the time. And as a child, bomb sites were fantastic. They were so much better than a park because you never quite knew what you're going to find on a bomb site. And you'd get bits of shrapnel. And then one boy found a fortunately no longer in use hand grenade once, I remember.
Wow.
Whoa.
That was really exciting. And so I had an older brother and then a younger brother came along as well. And we were a pretty happy family. I remember in the mornings my dad used to come in from doing the night shift on the beat. And he'd sort of come in looking exhausted while we were all getting ready to go to school and unbutton his police collar and have a cup of tea. And coincidentally, today, May the 19th, 2022, would have been my dad's 100th birthday.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, let's raise a glass
Sid, dad. Sid Smith.
PC Sid
PC Smith. PC Sid Smith, yeah. He never rose above the rank of PC, and he became a jailer in the end because he'd had quite a war. He'd been captured at El Alamein and then spent 2.5 years as a prisoner of war. And he ended the war in Colditz Castle, in fact, which was quite a story. And then when in the year of my birth, Colditz, the film came out and then the TV series subsequently. So he became a little bit of a local celebrity because he'd been in Colditz. Although Colditz was mainly full of officers and prominente, as they were called, who could potentially be used as hostages. So, but my dad never quite worked out why he was there then, because he was just a PC and his job was to sweep up and make tea for the posh guys. So my joke is that he was obliged to wipe the arse of a bunch of old Etonians, as we must all continue to do.
Very, very true.
And was he quite open about that period of his life? Because with the war and stuff, was he?
Well,
was he happy to talk about it?
He was. Well, he had a sort of selection of stories that he'd tell, and he didn't really go much beyond them. But when he retired, we got him to write these stories down in a memoir that he wrote. Which does tell the story of, the day he actually went over the top at El Alamein, the capture, and then subsequently how they went to these terrible a camp in Italy where his weight dropped to 6 stone. Wow. Yeah, and he was about the same size as me. And he always used to say, we used to eat anything. We used to eat dogs. And I said, oh, what does dog taste like? And he said, oh, it's a bit like rat.
You know.
Yeah, obviously. But in fact, the memoir that he wrote, which covers really his war years and then some of his time on the beat, it kind of stops around when he was around 40 or 45. We're probably going to be, I'm in talks about having it published with an introduction by me.
Amazing, that'd be great.
Yeah, because his stories are really funny, a lot of them. He had lots of stories about drunken women trying to kiss him, for example, and mainly he was dealing with drunks, but then he became eventually the jailer at Kennington Nick, and because he never really liked arresting anyone. I think after, you know, having been a prisoner himself for 2 years, yeah, 2.5 years, he was on the side of the prisoners. So he was a very generous and gentle man, although he was a good boxer too. You wouldn't want to get involved in a fight with him. He used to say that he'd get drunks come up to him and he could just push them over if they started getting violent. It was no trouble at all.
It's a great name as well, Sid Smith. Yeah. It's a solid name. Yeah. It's a very, very
Sid
solid
name.
Sid
with a Y, which is unusual.
That is unusual.
I don't quite know why there's the Y instead of the I, but anyway.
So I guess some of that storytelling has kind of come off on you a little bit, obviously, with your career. But, do you think that's kind of where you maybe got some of that from?
Yeah, I think that and from my mother, who was, although she wasn't as extrovert as him, but she always was interested in books. And when we were kids, she used to take us to the theatre, and the National Theatre had just opened, and, we'd queue up and get tickets. So she introduced us to words and eloquence, but Sid was good at stories, and he did love an old joke, there's no doubt. I'll tell you a couple if you like.
We'd love to hear some, yeah.
Right. A man goes to the doctor. The doctor says, "I'm afraid you're going to have to stop masturbating." "Oh, no," says the man. "Why?" "Well," says the doctor, "I'm trying to examine you." Actually, that wasn't one of his, but I know a lot of old jokes, and I attribute most of them obviously to Barry Cryer, who just died a couple of months ago. Yeah. And his funeral was a wonderful event. He was a great man.
Yeah, and universally loved within the industry. I think we've had a few people that have come on and talked.
Yeah, he came up in a podcast recently, didn't he?
Yeah, and clearly a very, very warmly loved man.
He used to ring me up on my birthday every year. And from all the other people I've heard who he used to ring up on their birthday, he must have started every day by being on the phone for about an hour and a half. And he usually had some new joke or something. Because when I started doing stand-up comedy, there was a kind of rift between alternative comedy, as it was called then, or alternative cabaret, and the kind of old-school stuff, which was, guys in suits and often telling jokes, the Bernard Manning type ones, which were kind of racist and homophobic. And so there was a kind of big wall between the two types of comedian at the time. But Barry was, one who put his hand over the wall and was always very generous. He was a wonderful man.
Yeah, heard that many times, actually. I think that is important in that industry, though, isn't it? That to have people that do put their hand across the divide.
I think it's
everyone there for the same
everything.
Reason.
Yeah,
quite.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it's better to try and listen to other people and, if possible, make some connection with them, even if you might thoroughly disagree with everything they say. Although, having said that, there's a few right-wing Tories out there I think I'd have a job enjoying a dinner party with.
Yeah, maybe everyone has a limit, but I guess if the intent is there, Yeah, but it's not easy. It's not easy. But at least comedy's moved away, I guess, sorry, Giles, from that old style, the old style Bernard Manning kind of racist and jokes against someone, that has died out, really, hasn't it? I mean, I think that people have moved on from that.
Yeah, although, you know, there was a bit of a revival of that kind of stuff. I mean, I don't think anyone would really attempt racist stuff anymore. There's still a few male comedians who do rather sexist material. And I noticed the other day, what's her name, Julia Hartley Brewer, saying, oh, I'd laughed at a lot of rape jokes. I don't know any rape jokes, I must admit, and nor do I wish to, really.
No, quite.
Yeah, that's a weird thing to say as well, isn't it? It's a weird thing to announce to the world.
Yeah.
I found some rape jokes funny. I mean, goodness me.
I don't know if with people like her, because she's obviously sort of a right-wing talk radio kind of person. I think that all of her ilk, I think a lot of it's just attention-seeking.
Yeah.
Like they say this outrageous stuff like that to try and get people either on their side going, yeah, me too, or to go, oh, you can't say that, that's outrageous. And it, both sides are attention. And
I think
that is essentially the sort of currency they move in.
Clickbait, isn't it, really? Mm. So, and you can get paid more if more people are, I suppose, are paying, you know, paying attention to you. I think Piers Morgan's a bit prone to that, isn't he? You know, you say something that you know is going to piss people off, and then lots of people jump in, and then more people are listening to you, and you're making more money. I think a lot of it comes just down to that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I wonder if, like, sorry to get sort of quite deep early on, but I get that, and like we all move in kind of like noisy circles, and there's a lot of noise to try and make yourself heard from, whether it's the entertainment industry or I guess, you know, other circles. But deep down, at the end of the day, if you're making your money and making your currency and your attention from saying outrageous things that maybe you don't even necessarily believe, you're just saying them for attention, what have you got at the end of the day, apart from a bit more money and people hating you? Mm. You know, shouldn't we really all be sort of like powered on by our actual core beliefs?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's I mean, of course, social media has exacerbated that a lot more, isn't it? Because at any time of day or night, you can go on Twitter or something and find someone who's annoying you and start shouting at them. Yeah. Yeah, I do think sometimes I wish I should withdraw from Twitter, for example. I don't really do Instagram. My joke is I used to think that was just a really efficient drug dealer. But it's very easy to get caught up in endless sort of scrolling and caught up in ridiculous arguments and things. I think there's a lot to be said for people who say, look, just put your phone down and go out without it and have a little walk around the common.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, well, it's interesting to say, like Instagram, I think they are like drugs, social media. They are, you know, we're getting these dopamine hits every time we post something, and I've recently come off Twitter, and I honestly, it's almost like life changing. I feel it's like a sobriety in a way.
Yeah.
I think coming away from it, you start to realise how embedded you are in it, and what you're putting out there. What actually does it all mean, really?
Mm.
What actually are you getting out of it?
Did you find it difficult to come off it?
No, I was getting some like nasty messages, like you say, people just put out, you know, they will jump on anything you say. And I thought, you know what, I'm not enjoying this. This isn't enjoyable. So, yeah, I suppose the first first couple of weeks, maybe like you're sort of tempted to sort of dive back in and have a look what's going on. But post that, I'm feeling very relaxed and calm and finding other things to do which are more enjoyable,
yeah.
I think is the main thing, isn't it?
Yeah, although I've been recently afflicted by a condition known as CBA. Do you know what that is? Right.
Can't be asked.
No.
Can't be asked.
Can't be asked, yes.
Yeah. I suffer from the same affliction.
Well, I do my best, and I turn up to be gigs and whatnot, but I do often, you know, sit in the garden and do nothing rather than doing something I probably ought to be doing, writing my novel or, you know, changing the world for the better. But there's a lot to be said for saving. If more people did CBA, I think we'd have less trouble in the world.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I sometimes think that if we slept for, who is it, koala bears or something, sleep for 18 hours a day and then sort of get up, have something to eat, see if they can find a partner and then go back to sleep for another 18 hours.
Make those 6 hours you're awake really efficient and just sleep.
Yeah.
Oh, there's like definitely something to be said for that.
Sleeping is the best thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless you're really having a terrible dream. I know, I'm sure we all have sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I was interested, Arthur, you were saying that you were the middle child, because that's always something that people say, oh, they're a middle child. Did you, you got on well with your brothers, though?
Yeah, I still get on well with both of them, yeah. I mean, my elder brother, who's 2 years older than me, is a sort of force of nature. I mean, we came from, you know, it's quite a humble background, obviously, but he was always top of the class. And then he went to medical school and he became a doctor briefly. And then he ended up as the editor of the British Medical Journal.
Wow.
Yeah. And even now he's always posting blogs and he runs various, he's retired from the BMJ, but he now organises various medical conferences and blah, blah. So I was always kind of following in his wake. So all his achievements and ability to do stuff kind of kept me going as well, I think. And I kind of went along behind it, although obviously I chose to go into a different field than he did. And my younger brother, who's a civil servant who lives in Tunbridge, I still have a very good relationship with him. In fact, we a month ago, our mother died, and she was 92, you know, and we organised a funeral together, and we all got on really well. And I think of friends of mine who have bad relationships with their siblings, so we were pretty lucky, really, I'd say. Do you have disputes with brothers and sisters, or...?
I guess there was a period of time where me and my brother probably didn't, not that we didn't get on, but maybe not didn't hang out as much together, which I think is quite normal.
But
I certainly have a very good relationship now with him. And I know, Jim, you have good relationships with your sibling.
I wonder if it's an age thing. Sometimes the older you get, you sort of realise maybe what's more important. I'm really sorry to hear about your mum, by the way, Arthur.
Well,
and clearly your older brother does not suffer from CBA either.
No,
he's got
the opposite.
Given what he's done.
He's got
I don't know what the opposite would be.
BA. Well, it's the same. It's just can be asked to do everything.
Can be asked. Exactly the same. But I think with siblings and stuff, you obviously can't pick your siblings, can you? You know,
no.
You pick your friends, you can't pick your siblings. So it's one of these things that you're just kind of you're stuck with them, really. But I found as I got older, I've definitely got closer to my siblings, definitely. And I don't know if it's just just an aging or just luck. I just lucked out that they're just
Well, we were lucky as well. We had to get together to support our mother, who after my dad died started, and she could feel it tipping into dementia, which her mother had had and her sister. And it was a very difficult period she was thinking, oh, I don't really give a shit. And then she started drinking as well and used to be found wandering in the streets occasionally. But eventually she went into a home where the carers were fantastic. But that was quite a hard few years. Dementia's really not a very nice thing. Dementia's really not a nice thing. Dementias, you can always get a laugh with dementia.
It is an incredibly cruel disease. I know my grandmother had dementia near the end, for the few years before she passed away. And and it comes in many different forms. She used to get quite aggressive.
Yeah, my mother occasionally. Usually not. I mean, in fact, by the end, she was sort of been this little song in her head that was going on all the time. But I might recite a little poem I wrote. Shall I?
Yeah, love to hear it.
This is a poem about my mother. This was when she was having quite a hard time. Anyway, right, here it is. Arriving home after the party, they see her, their neighbour, standing in the street. She asks them for a lift to London, back home to London. Hazel, they say, this is your home. London's 30 miles away. her door is open and they take her in and find she has packed a bag, if a packet of biscuits and a jumper count as packing. Oh, Hazel, it is 35 years since you left London to live, as you like to say, in the Shires. But there she still is, the grammar school girl from Camberwell Green, dancing, kissing sailors in Trafalgar Square. It is VE Day, and the rest of the century is yours.
Oh, that's beautiful, Arthur.
That is beautiful.
Hey, VE Day, that must have been a hell of a party.
It must have been. Yeah, it must have been. So have you always written poetry? Is that something that's always been part of your life?
Yeah. I've always liked poetry, and I do write poetry. I mean, I can't claim to be the poet laureate, although I do know him, Simon Armitage.
So you're only one away.
In fact, I met him at the Oscar Wilde Society meeting a while back. I don't really know about that. It's a bunch of people. I think Giles Brandreth organises it. And they have a party every year to celebrate Oscar Wilde on his birthday or something. And, what was I talking about there? The dementia's kicking in.
Poetry.
Simon Armitage.
Yes, Simon Armitage.
Oh, sorry,
And I occasionally learn poetry, and I learned a little bit of one of his poems and recited it to him, which was he was very pleased with. You young pretender, it's the last bit of a poem called Goalkeeper with a Cigarette. You young pretenders, keepers of the naught, the niche, defenders of the sweet fuck all, think bigger than your pockets, profiles, health, better by half to take a sideways view. Take a tip from me and deface yourselves. That's Simon Armitage.
That's very relevant, isn't it? Very, very relevant currently, yeah, what we're talking about. That's,
do you
that's
love a bit of poetry?
On.
I love poetry. I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of Wendell Berry. He does kind of more natural world kind of poetry. And I'm a big fan of Simon as well. I've got quite a few of his books.
I
love poetry. My favourite poet's Sharon Olds. She wrote a brilliant book called The Father, which is all about her father passing away from a terminal cancer, and it's just so visceral.
What's her name? I don't know.
Sharon Olds.
Oh, I'll look that up.
Yeah, The Father. I would highly recommend it to anybody. It's a absolutely beautiful book. Very obviously very poignant and sad as well. But yeah, she's a tremendous poet. So yeah, I'm a big fan of poetry. You know, I write poetry. I've written a couple of verse novels as well. So
yeah,
it's always been a big part of my life, poetry.
When we come to the end of this, perhaps we should all recite a poem. I'm game, if you're not.
Yeah.
Can you learn any of yours by heart?
I don't. I'm really bad at that, actually. No. I'd like to do, because I keep meaning I'd like to do like a live reading of one of my novels as a complete thing, as a complete night. But and I think if I did that, I would definitely want to try and learn a lot of it by heart.
Oh, it's a lot to learn a whole
book. It would
be.
Do you guys think? Because I have to admit, growing up, and maybe a bit now, I think poetry kind of scared me a little bit. That because it seems so sort of like beautifully put together and intelligent, and I think maybe I find it a bit sort of daunting sometimes. But I really enjoyed listening to you recite a poem then, and I wonder if that's more an accessible way for me to get into poetry. I think there's.
Go to slam or something, man. Like
I think on the page.
Open mic type sort of thing.
Yeah, on the page, I think I find it quite daunting, but I think I'd find it more accessible.
Yeah, most poetry is better, really, read aloud, like Shakespeare and whatnot.
Mm.
I'm definitely going to do a couple of poems at the end.
We'd love that.
Yeah.
We'd absolutely
that'd be amazing.
It.
Yeah.
So did you do? Lovely. Did you go to those kind of like recitals and things? Did you? Were you into that as well?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I used to go when I was at university in Norwich, East Anglia University. I used to go to the poetry night. In fact, I was. That's right. I was chair of the university poetry society.
Oh, amazing.
We used to go along, we used to go to this pub, what was it called, little pub in Norwich out the back and sit there. And of course, and everyone read, there were a few old, you know, well-known poems, and then everyone read their own poems, some of which were absolutely fucking terrible. That was all right. They were quite short, but, you know, if you saw someone with about 10 pages and they...
Yeah, ring binder, yeah.
Yeah, and they started off and it was pretty grim stuff. You sort of, oh, God, I don't know how much more I can take of this.
So what, okay, because I do find this stuff interesting. What is at the heart of a good poem then? What makes a, is it just something that like really comes from the heart, or does it have to be written in a certain way, or are there tropes to avoid? Like what makes a good poem?
Well, I think if you're going to write a poem about the moon, bear in mind there have been a lot of poems about the moon. there's a definition, you know, poetry is that which cannot be translated. In a way, it's the combination of words carving out a meaning in the air that can only be done through poetry. I don't know even you even define poetry, really. It's more thoughtful prose, perhaps, or
yeah. But you know, like sometimes when you're writing and maybe this is more prevalent in poetry than other forms of writing, and you get something in your head, maybe it might be like a little phrase,
yeah,
or something that's like, it's like bearing down in your mind,
yeah,
and you think, oh, that's really good, I'm going to write that down. And then like you see it written down and you think, that looks fucking terrible. there's a process sometimes, isn't there? Maybe that's part of just creativity, that you have to write something bad sometimes and then it becomes something good.
Yeah, but often poems do start with one image or one thought. I've got in the back of my head the phrase, little do we know. Because whenever I look at photos or something from years ago, somewhere in my head I'm thinking, well, little did he know what was going to happen, and little do we know, really. I don't know. I'm like, I'm with, was it Socrates said, all I know is I don't know fuck all.
Yeah.
Although, and it's always slightly annoying when you meet people who do apparently know everything and are utterly convinced that they're right about everything.
Yeah, there seems to be quite a few of those people around, in the particularly in the media. We talked about some of them earlier.
We covered them earlier.
Yeah.
So did were you performing poetry as well? Your own poetry, obviously being the chair of the university's poetry society.
Yeah, I did do a bit of poetry, but then I kind of, and some of it tipped into comedy, and then, you know, but really I went for the sound of laughter was the thing that really got me going. And so, because I always remember when I was, well, I must have only been about six or seven at primary school, and the teacher came in and said, we're going to do a version of Peter Pan to all the parents at Christmas or something. And I was terribly excited by this, and I went home and wrote my version of Peter Pan, which was obviously unperformable. But the teacher said, well, yeah, we can't quite do it like that, but you can play any part you want. So I went for Captain Hook, obviously.
Oh, it's the best part.
Oh, yeah. And my mother got me, a coat hanger to put in for my hand and whatnot to do the hook. And I came on stage intending to terrify everyone in the audience with my scary Captain Hook routine. But they all started laughing instead. And the more I ran around trying to terrorise people as Captain Hook, the louder the laughter. And actually, I quite enjoyed it. I think it was kind of then I thought, oh, yeah, laughter. I love the sound of laughter. And, as Victor Borger said, laughter is the shortest distance between two people.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful quote, actually. Yeah,
that's lovely.
If you can laugh together, then clearly things are going well.
Yeah, especially, again, going back to earlier, especially if you do have differences, you're people that might come at life from different angles, But if you can laugh, then you've found something common. If you found something, you both
you know,
find
even
funny.
If you don't speak the language of someone else, you know, and you're trying to communicate, laughter is the thing that might bring you together. It's a funny thing, isn't it? I always think it's the closest we ever sound to, like, chimpanzees or something, is when people laugh. Yeah. You know, that strange noise we make. There's nothing quite like it, is it? Well, there's farting, I suppose, but that's not...
That's not farting, those two things come together a lot of the time.
For laughter.
Farting and laughter, yeah, the two true universal languages.
Well, I do sometimes think, well, you know, people pay me to stand in front of them and make them laugh, but they, you know, you don't pay someone to make you belch or fart or yawn.
Well, we'll probably get a few laughs, though, to be fair.
At
the start.
Farting get old. Farting quickly. Is always funny, obviously, mainly if you're 7 or 8. But if one of us does...
I don't know, Arthur. I still might be quite amusing.
Yeah, but, like, you know, if some very respectable or powerful world leader gets up and is making a big spit and does a big fart, everyone in the world is laughing. Yeah. You should have more farting, I think.
I think so too.
Yeah. I don't think it's what it used to be. I think it's kind of going out of fashion, farting.
Yeah, I think it is.
We need to bring it back. Please, can one of you fart for me? That's the trouble.
I can't. No. I think farting on demand, I think, is a real skill.
That, yeah.
If you can do that,
well, there is
the trouble.
There are acts.
Le Petit-Main was the famous.
Le Petit-Main, they reckon you could hear the laughter 20 miles away. He used to fart the Marseillaise and he used to light his fart. There was a film of it, wasn't there? Do you remember?
Leonard Rossiter played him.
That's right. I'd love to see that again.
There's a brilliant moment in that where he has an unfortunate accident during one of his routines. Yeah. And next day he's sitting in bed. Like, you know, with a hot water bottle and everything. And he's like, please pass me the charcoal biscuits.
I used to have a friend, a lady, who could do fanny farting at will.
Wow.
I know. It's quite a skill. In fact, we used to do it. I used to get her to do it sometimes on stage occasionally. I won't say her name because I think she's a bit embarrassed about it these days. And she's
moved away from that.
Yeah, and she's also married to a very famous person whose name I also won't say.
Oh, man.
Anyway, a whole farting show. Yeah, let's bring back the Petal Man.
There you go. That's your next Edinburgh Fringe show.
Yeah, maybe, I haven't really got the skill there. It always makes me laugh that because the French for fart is pété. And one fart is spelt P-E-T, pet. So I always think that if people need if French people see a sign saying you need a pet passport, that must be...
To be fair, I mean, if you did a whole show about farting in French, you could call it pet sounds.
Yeah. Well, there you are. Maybe we should do one, the three of us.
Yeah, okay. That's our next project.
Yeah, a farting podcast. Fartcast.
Fartcast. Oh, do you know what? That actually would do really well. I genuinely think that would do
really well.
I'll go to Google farting podcast because I'm sure there are some out
there. Oh, there's bound to be at least 12 or 13.
Oh, yeah. I'm intrigued to see what you get. Have you got anything?
Right, there's already a dozen that I can see on here.
There you go.
There's a category on Player FM called Best Farting Podcast 2022.
Oh, no. So there's like a top 10.
Yeah, it's one of the top one's called Send Us Your Farts. I guess that's pretty self-explanatory.
The Send Us Your Farts, how long is an episode? Because I mean, if that's like half an hour or an hour of just people's fart sounds.
At what point does that not become funny? At what point does
I think, to be honest, if once I've watched about 10 minutes of farting, I'd maybe want to move on. Maybe 15 if they're really good.
Yeah, if it's really good.
Yeah. Imagine, did the Petal Man do a whole show? He was probably just a 20-minute act or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, I mean, but the impression I got from that I was going to say documentary because it felt like one. The thing with Leonard Rosser was it was like a full show, like in a theatre with So it must have, you know, if you're paying money to see that, you'd want at least half an hour.
Yeah.
He's this guy basically gets people to send him in farts. The latest episode is 24 minutes long.
Because the actual fart's not going to be that long, is it?
No, well, that's good. No, that's a selection of the farts.
Can't we hear a little bit of farting?
Can't you look at play a little bit of it?
We'll have to maybe edit a little bit in.
I'll edit some in. I don't know how I can do that live.
Yeah, I assume he's commentating on them and sort of maybe rating them or something.
Yeah, on his homepage says, "I review submitted farts." And then he sent an email address. There's an email address. It gets better. Sometimes solo or with guests. So farts bringing people together. Collaborative.
Yeah, exactly.
I think he's cornered the market. I don't think we can top that.
You said there were 12 other ones as well.
Yeah. The fart locker, all fart, no poop.
See, as well, it's an international thing, isn't it? Farting, everyone can understand a fart, and everyone like laughter.
Yeah. I said universal language. no, there's loads. It looks like there's upwards of 30 or 40.
Is there a belching one as well?
There must be. I mean, I wonder if some of these maybe overlap possibly and might be going to add bodily sounds.
Yeah.
I'm going to do burping podcasts. Let's have a look.
There's only really burping, farting. There's nothing else quite like that, is there?
No, not that would sort of... No, not that has the same sort of universal...
Sneezing?
It's sneezing.
Not as funny though, is it, sneezing? I don't
coughing,
think.
Yeah, no.
No, it depends on the sneeze, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a best burp podcast category. I mean, there's just...
It's part of the same network, is it?
Same network, yeah. The slight problem with online...
From the guys that bought you podcast.
There's the slight sort of problem, I guess, with online content now. It's like, if you've thought of an idea, as the three of us just have, someone's done it. Like, it's very difficult now, I think, to come up with, I guess, something that someone hasn't done, and probably quite well. At some point,
I'd like to hear a symphony of farts, belches, sneezes, coughs. You know, someone should make it. Well, they probably have done it already, obviously.
Yeah.
It's the,
that's playing some sort of, like a national anthem or something in.
Yeah. Or create an entirely new symphony.
Yeah. A musical, perhaps.
Yeah.
An orchestra.
Perhaps we should move on from farting.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
I think probably our listeners have had enough.
Sorry.
So obviously you did the poetry stuff, but when did the comedy come about then? When were you starting to sort of dabble with the comedy?
Well, like I say, when I was Captain Hook, at school I used to occasionally go on and do a joke in assembly or do a little funny thing, which I was allowed to do. And then we had the school review. I can't remember much about it, but that was like a little funny show we put on for the parents. And then at university, we used to do the university review, as it was. I mean, you call them reviews then. I mean, I suppose you'd call them sketch shows now. And then a little group of us got together and went up to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe in 1977. And that's really the place. I mean, you know, that's a playground of the imagination, and nearly all the work I've done one way or another started out at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in August. And in fact, it's the 75th anniversary of the Edinburgh Festival and the Fringe this year. Yeah. And I'm doing a show called My 75 Years at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Excellent.
But, which I'm going to pretend on. Well, the first nine years, I did a show called I Haven't Been Born Yet. But then I'm going to kind of reminisce about show, because I've done all sorts of funny shows, and I've written plays that started there, and I did an art festival 1 year of paintings and ridiculous sculptures, and I've done stand up, and I was in a double act, and I do these outdoor walking shows as well, which I've done over the years. They're fun. It's a great thing to do a show outdoors where you take your people with you. There's no set on earth quite like the open air of Edinburgh. Mm. Yeah. And I used to do these ones, which I'll probably do it again this year, called my late night tour of the Royal Mile, which didn't start till 2 or 3 a.m. And I mean, back in my drinking days in the 90s, they were pretty wild. I got arrested at the end of one of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm quite proud of that. There's not many comedians can say they got arrested at the end of a gig. A couple. There's Lenny Bruce.
About to say, you and Lenny Bruce. Yeah.
There was one other guy, actually, when I used to compare a lot at a club called Jonglers in the 90s, there was a guy who was on doing, he was fairly new, and he was just doing 5 or 10 minutes, but his name was in Time Out, which used to advertise. And he came off stage, he'd done okay, and was immediately arrested. And it turned out he was a wanted man, and some copper had seen his name in Time Out, and they'd come along and arrested him, which, I mean, that is a big heckle. I mean,
yeah. Also, it's nice that they let him do his show before.
Well, I suppose that made sure they knew who he was, I suppose. Or they were sort of checking him out on the, Yeah, so I've done these wild late-night tours of the Royal Mile in Edinburgh. Yeah, so I'll be off to Edinburgh in a couple of months. I better start writing my show.
Yeah.
So did you get arrested for on the outdoor gig?
Well, it was... There was a comedian, if you ever look him up, he was quite a legend, called Malcolm Hardy, who used to run dodgy clubs, and he'd done a bit of time in prison for nicking cars. And he came out of prison and became a sort of comedian. And he used to run gigs where he'd book people that no one else would. And he apparently learned this after he died. He drowned in the River Thames, pissed in about 2004 or something. But he always used to ring the police up at the start of my tour. Said, "Oh, there's a lot of trouble here up the Royal Mile. You better get down here, lads." Because as far as he was concerned, that always added to the entertainment. So quite often the police would turn up. And I've got a picture somewhere of him standing naked on top of a porter cabin in just his socks with a policeman arresting him. But anyway, he called the police. And on this particular one where I got arrested, it was there'd been a bit of nudity and a bit of shouting. I'll tell you about that after, but there were some funny incidents on these tours. But then suddenly the police came in, and Simon Munnery, the comedian, sort of brushed one away, and he was arrested for resisting arrest or something. So he was taken to police station. I thought, well, if anyone gets arrested, I should. So I followed him down to the police station. And then they took me in and arrested me for breach of the peace and possession of a megaphone, is what they said. And the following year, I had to go to a little court session, and I was fined £100. And I offered to pay at the time, but they said, "Oh, no, we'll send you a thing." But they never did. So I still owe the Edinburgh Police Force £100. They don't seem to come after me for it, but I am technically a wanted man, I suppose.
Yeah. that's quite a nice thing to have under your belt. I was going to say,
Have you ever been arrested, either of
I've
you?
I've never been arrested. I've never been arrested.
No. Neither of you?
No, not
we're quite
close.
Jim and I.
But just like on Malcolm Hardy, quickly, there's an award after him, isn't there, for like most kind of like out there marketing campaign for Edinburgh. Is that right?
That's right. The Malcolm Hardy Cunning Stunts Award or something.
That's right.
But I think I got a prize at it 1 year when I said that critics could only review my show if they came on stage and juggled kippers. And one or two of them did, to be fair to them.
And then how did they review you after that?
I got a 2 kipper star review. Yeah, well, Malcolm Alder, you should look him up. He was really quite, you know, he had an instinctive ability to do the least sensible thing in any situation. And he eventually ended up, he used to run a club on a boat called the Wibbly Wobbly, funny enough, down near Bermondsey, where I grew up. Yeah. And he fell in the river one night, rowing back to his own boat, which he lived on, like, just across. And, you know, and his funeral was just the best gig I've ever been to. It took place in St. Alphege's Church in Greenwich. He was a Greenwich boy. And, you know, Jules Holland played and Joe Brand spoke and Stuart Lee. And wow. And then he was carried out to return to sender. And every comedian at the time was in that church, and it was just the funniest and saddest event I've ever attended. I don't ever expect to go to a better gig than that. Mm. Have you been to a funeral lately?
not recently, thankfully, but I'm sure there'll be more to come. I was thinking, like, you've been going to the festival since 1977. Obviously, you've probably seen a lot of changes. How has it changed over those years? I mean, obviously, and I'm not saying that people weren't serious back in the day, but is there a more, it feels like, you know, it's very much more, people are more driven perhaps now to make sure this is a very poignant moment, you know, in their career to be at Edinburgh.
Well, I used to have a thing, I'll say, about a little poem that went, I'll get spotted, I'll get paid, I'll get drunk, I'll get laid. It's a sort of, it was not as big when I first went up. It is the biggest arts festival in the world by some measure. There are thousands and thousands of shows. And then there's the official festival, which is, the Berlin Philharmonic and whatnot. And then there's the fringe. But even the fringe is a bit divided between the fringe where that was the more regular venues and the free fringe, which means you can just go up and people put money in a hat at the end of a show. And it's, the great thing about it is that, unlike any other festival, anyone can go. You know, you can go and do your farting show this year if you want.
I'm excited about it.
And you can just do it in a phone box, or you can find any sort of a venue. So there's a kind of wild freedom about the event. Most festivals in the world, you're invited to go and it's professionals doing it. But Edinburgh is a free-for-all. It's getting, I don't know how much it's going to change this year since, because it was cancelled a couple of years ago. And there weren't so many last year, obviously, because of the pandemic. I don't know. I think it's going to be a bit different. And now it gets more and more expensive to go, especially for accommodation.
Yeah,
there's nowhere to stay. And so people let their flats out for £5,000 a week or something. So it's getting harder, I think. And who knows? But it remains, you know, just a riot of the imagination and a playground where you can try anything.
Yeah, and I guess as well a place where you can sort of come into contact with people that look at the world in a similar way, or not, but you know, creatively.
Well, there's all sorts of people. You can go and see all your friends or other comedians, new people. And there's the jazz festival, the film festival, the TV festival, the farting festival that's starting this year. There's a billion things to do. And, of course, Edinburgh is, I always think it's probably the most attractive-looking city in Britain, probably.
Yeah. It's. I mean, we've mentioned the farting show so often now, I think we're actually going to have to do it. The marketing's already done for us.
Yeah, well, we'll do it on the free fringe, I think.
It's a very free fringe show, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, yeah. We'll do it on free fringe. I don't know if people will put anything in the bucket at the end, but we can give it a go.
That's what they'll put in the bucket.
I was about to say, they might be worried about what's been in the bucket, I think, possibly.
Yeah, it might need very good very good air conditioning or something, I think.
Yeah, maybe it's an outdoor show. Maybe it's an outdoor gig.
Yeah. Do it on top of Arthur's seat.
Arthur's seat, yeah.
Which they named after me after I've been up there for a few years.
There you go. Yeah. Places are working out perfectly. Yeah. Arthur's, which also it sounds like another word for a bum anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah, Arthur's exactly.
So,
yeah, the fart festival on Arthur's seat.
Yeah. I mean, that could win a Malcolm Hardy, actually.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Well, Malcolm, famously, there was an occasion when there was someone asleep in the front row and he was on stage and he just weed over him.
Oh, my God.
I know. I mean, the things he did, Malcolm, are ridiculous. But then everyone laughed, and then the bloke woke up and he was really pleased that he'd been weed on and been the centre of attention.
Wow, okay. Not the reaction I'd have had, I don't think, to being weed on, but, you know, everyone's different. Everyone has their own different...
Oh, yeah, I mean, some people, that's quite a thing, isn't it?
No, we're not doing a show about that.
Yeah, it's not something that appeals to me, I have to say.
No, there's definitely an audience for it, but I think we should stick to the farting. That's as far as we should go.
Yeah.
I'm interested though, because obviously you do so much stuff and rather than you know sort of these days it's very, you're sort of told like pick your thing, stick to it. If you want to be a stand-up comedian, pick stand-up and do it. If you want to be a poet, pick poetry, do it. But like you've done so much different stuff and it obviously hasn't hindered you. Do you think there's a sort of beauty in actually maybe doing a bit of everything, or do you think to progress, you do need to...
Yeah, that's like when I had my archer art movement. I suddenly thought, because I had a good friend who was a proper artist and I got to know a bit about the art world, and I thought, well, I'll try that. Yeah, it's nice to try new ideas. And who knows, you know, maybe I'm not... You can be a bit good at everything, maybe. I agree. Most people just sort of stick with the one line, but I think the world's more interesting if you look outside of your principal activity. How long we got, boys? I'm longing to go for a walk around the common soon.
5 more minutes, we'll give, if that's all right.
Yeah, remember, I'm ending on a poem.
Yeah, I've got one ready as well.
Good. We all got one, yeah.
I don't have one, but I will bask in the glory of you guys. Maybe I'll do a fart at the end. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. If you can get one ready.
Yeah. How do you do that? How do you prepare a fart?
Know.
You'd have to
prepare a fart like it's a sort of meal. I don't,
well, to make your body in a farty condition.
Like I'm preparing for a big match at Wembley. I'm fart ready. I'm. I don't know. I'll try.
Let it out before you go on. You know, that would be
really
annoying.
You don't want to peak too early.
No.
So, yeah, Arthur, what I wanted to ask you was about, obviously, you coming out as a comedian in the late 70s, and we talked a bit about, you know, those working man's clubs and the style of comedy at that town and obviously trying to be more of an alternative comedian. And I wondered how difficult that was. That must have been quite... challenging, I guess. I'm assuming you weren't alone, obviously, in doing that. You weren't the only one doing it. But
there weren't that many of us at the beginning. Yeah. There were just, I mean, but there were more and more little clubs opening, first in London and then around the country. And there were new styles. People were doing more observational material rather than just gags. I like a gag, but the old school, they were... gags that you could sort of share between you, really, or people used to say, "Have you doing that one or that one?" Whereas it became a more personal thing, and you'd have people like Sean Hughes say, used to do shows about his own problems, or I mean, that's more and more common amongst comedians now, to people talking about their mental health, and of course the big division then was Thatcher. Or not, you know, we were all desperately anti-Thatcher, obviously. And I remember the Falklands when that happened. There was the comedy store was about the only place you could go where people would say, "Yeah, I'm against the Falklands War." But it's expanded, and you know, things move on, and people die, and new people appear on the scene. It's an endlessly fluid, progressive world we live in. But we'll all be dead soon anyway from climate change.
Maybe. No, I think you're probably right. Someone on the radio was talking about climate change today, and it's like that. It's like the biggest elephant you could ever think of in a room, and we're all just like cracking on with our little lives while this thing looms over us. Because I do think we're probably in trouble. But anyway, let's try and end the pod on a lighter note.
A bit, but yeah.
But I just really quickly then, before we sort of move on to the poetry and the farting, I do think there's an element of like people talking. It's interesting you're talking about that was the moment maybe where people started being more truthful on stage about themselves and stuff, which is definitely 100% a really sort of prevalent sort of part of stand-up comedy now. But it's more relatable, surely, because if you're talking about stuff, your problems or things like that, things that ail you on stage, and then making it funny, I think that's one of the most relatable thing you can do, because there'll be people in the audience that will, from various walks of life, that will relate to that.
Yeah, I mean, no one's completely happy. Well, maybe they are, but they'd be very annoying if they are. Yeah, everyone's got doubts about the world and certain issues. So to see it presented on stage, there's a community there as well, and the laughter will bring you together in it, And you can deal with any subject, though, in a way, with comedy. You can talk about history or, you can... Anything is up for grabs if you can get a laugh from it.
Yeah, because obviously that's been a debate recently, what things, you know, constitute as being funny. And if you can go to certain places with comedy, do you feel like you can pretty much broach most subjects with comedy?
Yeah, pretty much, depending, people talk about punching up and punching down. You can kind of approach any subject, providing you're not punching down, as I say, providing you're not being the superior one, taking the piss out of someone less less self-confident or anything is potentially open. I mean, some subjects you've got to be very careful with.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think if you're coming at things from a place of compassion, I guess, and trying to be respectful, but at the same time making it funny, I think you're probably okay, I guess, but it's an interesting one. I don't know where I'm going with that. I'm just thinking about the poetry and the farting, to be totally honest.
Well, Arthur, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. Enjoy your walk around the common.
I will.
Thanks, Arthur.
All right. Cheers.
Can I take a quick photo, if that's possible?
And then I'll press the leave meeting button at the bottom right, which we've all got used to now.
There you go, Arthur Smith on the Blank podcast. What a legend. I mean, such an easy conversation. He's done so much. I mean, literally, he's so good at various forms of entertainment and creativity. But just a lovely guy. I love it when we've got people on. It normally happens with comedians where they're happy to indulge the silliness, which lots and lots.
We certainly did that on this one.
On this episode. And there's more on the Patreon, patreon.com/blankpodcast. Including some, you guys both read out a couple of poems as well, which is a really, really lovely moment as well. So if you want to hear that, do sign up to our Patreon.
Jim doesn't read out a poem because he's tempting something else miraculous in that section of the... of the
never podcast. Been heard before and never again since. But it's all a bit of fun, really.
No, I mean, I love talking about poetry. So it was really great for me to be able to chat about poetry, and obviously Arthur's very knowledgeable and just great, like I said, like a raconteur. He's just a great person to hear, anecdotes and stories about, and is happy to, delve into all sorts of different subjects, and I always enjoy the podcast where we go off on tangents and things and get a bit silly. It's always fun.
I think they're the best ones. I say that. I think the episodes where
we go really serious, I think are really important. And I think when we have guests that really come up and they're sort of like ready to really open about sort of a trauma or something, I think that's, that they are genuinely really important because people listening will be able to relate to them. But I do love it when we go on random tangents because it's just, the time flies by. I looked at the clock at one point and we were about 45 minutes in. I was like, well, we've barely scratched the surface. It was just such a fun chat. And I think you just have to go with it sometimes. And I think those make for good episodes. So it was just, yeah, ideal guest and a great guy.
Well, the power of the freeform conversation podcast, isn't it? You can, you know, it's a conversation as you would have with someone in the local cafe and have a cup of tea or whatever it might be. It's a chance to just chat.
Exactly.
You know, we've never got any agendas or anything, you and I. So if it goes where it goes, and yeah, sometimes it's silly, sometimes it's more emotional.
I think that's the beauty of actually you and I being independent as we are. Although, again, you can support us via our Patreon, is that we genuinely don't sit down and think, oh, we should talk about this. Yeah. We just sort of like see where it goes. And I hope that means that when our guests come on, they're very relaxed and don't feel like they're being forced into any sort of particular conversation, because you and I are genuinely happy with wherever it goes. And I hope that comes across with our listeners as well, that I hope that makes it an easy listen, because we're certainly not here trying to tick any boxes for certain headlines or anything. We're just here for a chat, to be honest. And I always leave, obviously I'm in my cabin at the end of the garden, my office. I always leave the office every time we've done one of these, and I walk back down my garden, and there's always a spring in my step, because I've always had a fun time or an interesting time or a particularly poignant time with our guests. So hopefully that translates to our listeners as well.
Or you've opened up your bowels. In which case you
or not, Charles?
Yeah, or not. Who knows? You have to listen to the Patreon. So that can put a swing in your step as well. But no, I agree. Without being too flippant, absolutely. Yeah, I always feel a bit of a buzz afterwards. Well, we've said it's our therapy session every week. We always feel good afterwards, and it's always great to chat to these amazing people. So very, very lucky.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. So thank you to Arthur for coming on. And being an absolute legend. And again, if you are going to the Edinburgh Festival, then do go and see him. Please come and see me as well. My Edinburgh show is now on sale, officially on sale. I think they've updated it with my the online one. I think with my new photo. I think so. I had a photo shoot. I'm gonna quickly check where my poster is being sorted out at the moment. But anyway, the show is called Jim Daly Football and Fatherhood, because it's about football and fatherhood. I thought I'd just make it very obvious in the show title. And I am, yes, they've updated it. Oh, that looks great. I'm at the Just the Tonic at the Grass Market Centre every day from the 4th till the 28th, apart from there's a few days in the middle where I'm going to my brother's wedding in Ireland. Nice. And you can pre-book a ticket for £5, but it's also sort of pay what you want. So you can turn up and just put money in the bucket at the end. But obviously, bear in mind, tickets may have been sold previously and you might not get a seat. But it's a 50-seater. So yeah, who knows? Who knows? Please. Yeah, really excited. So, if you're coming to Edinburgh, go and see Arthur. Come and see me. And there's loads of shows to go and see. I'm at 4:30 every day. I don't know if I said that. But, so quite a good time, hopefully. I need to probably... I'm probably going to mention the show a fair amount, if that's okay, on the on these pods, because I need to obviously sort of get people in. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a new book out, so everyone go and buy that. Well,
there you go. Exactly. There you go. Anyway. I think that's the end of this episode.
It is.
Thank you, Arthur, for coming on. Thank you to our listeners and our patrons. Thank you, Charles, as well.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure, as always.
It always is. And we're back next week, of course, with another episode on the Black Podcast. So until then, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and we'll see you again soon. Goodbye.
Media Podcast.